Is this on?
Oh. What, are you joining us on the panel tonight?
I think so. I'm not sure why.
Okay.
I'm not sure why, yes. Well, I don't know what I'm going to say. I should do this.
We're kind of... Yes.
I'm going to be another...
The physical logistics are such that the panelists would have been talking from there, but I have a feeling that for you to be able to hear it, it might be better if we just keep... either we keep passing this microphone, or if anybody has some long statement, then to go ahead and come up here if you want to do it. Okay, so Pete, you might, when we come to the point where you can come up here if you want to. Okay. All right. I always figured that, you know, transforming the society would be easy compared to handling the sound systems. Anyway, thank you for showing up for such a far-out topic. How many here first heard about holographic concepts, say, 10 or more years ago? I had a feeling there'd probably be some veterans in here. Okay. How many have never seen a hologram? Okay. It's a pretty sophisticated world if only one of us has never seen a hologram. Does anybody here have a hologram in their pocket?
Yes, I do. Oh. I always carry a hologram in my pocket, don't you? Doesn't everybody?
I used to take a big hologram with me occasionally. It was one that my publisher had made. Uh-huh. Okay, would you pass that back to the person who has not seen a hologram?
Well, where's the person who hasn't
right,
seen one?
Right back somewhere around there.
Well, come on up here.
No.
He don't toss his key away.
Where are you? These are the keys to my kingdom. I'll pass those anyway.
Okay, if you've seen holograms, you know that they're pretty strange. The first time you see one, you go, what? Because all of a sudden it looks like there's this three-dimensional thing, but it isn't real in the, I put quotes around the word real in the way this is. We're doing something tonight, just to add a little spice to what we're doing. Tonight's panel is being recorded also in holophonic sound. And how many here have ever heard of holophonic sound? Okay. How many have actually heard it? All right, that's quite a goodly number. The gentleman leaning over, whispering secrets up here in the front of the room, is Hugo Zuccarelli, who invented holophonic sound when he was a very young man. And I mean very young. When you listen to holophonic sound, you're listening through Hugo's ears when he was 24, right?
23. I was 21, sorry.
Okay, but young ears, but legal. And holophonic sound enables you to hear things in space as if it were happening normally. I'm just realizing, Hugo, for the sake of your recording device, we probably should pass the microphone around and not all come up to the same place. Because it's like sitting in the middle of a conversation. If you have something recorded holophonically, you actually can hear people talking. And you sit more or less with your eyes closed, you could not tell it from reality. Hugo speculated at that time, and speculated accurately, that the way we perceive things in space is because the ear broadcasts a coherent sound of its own. So that just as it takes a laser beam to be the coherent light source to make a hologram, your ear puts out its own coherent sound, and that it's interfered with by other sounds out there. And so you go, oh yeah, to my left, to my right, above, behind, so on. So we thought it would be interesting to do this, and also my company and the newsletter, New Sense Bulletin, formerly Brain Mind Bulletin, we've recently entered into a business arrangement with Hugo, a creative arrangement with Hugo, and we're going to start producing holophonic tape so that you can hear Tibetan bowls sounding all around your head, and that you can have like therapeutic processes and so on. Up until now, most of the work with holophonic sound has been things like having superstars, rock stars whispering into your ear and things like that. So we want to really get ourselves where we live. in 1977, I happened to be at a conference in, I think it was Texas. One of the speakers on the program was Carl Pribram, who was a neurosurgeon, neuroscientist, then at Stanford University. Carl was a pretty famous brain researcher. He was among the first people to really name the cognitive revolution, and he was the first person who developed surgical techniques that were so fine that they could explore what we now call the limbic brain. And Carl had proposed a few years earlier that it may be that our brains operate on a principle similar to that of the hologram. I'm going to say just a few things about it. Michael Talbot, whose book, The Holographic Universe, came out in May, will give you a much crisper and up-to-date feel for the holographic model, since he's been talking about it, being interviewed about it lately. So I'll just kind of tell you my personal experience of it. I was intrigued by it. I mentioned it briefly in a book I wrote called The Brain Revolution that came out in 1973. A man named Carl Lashley, a researcher in Florida, had wanted to get into the brain and figure out where he wanted to find the engram. And that was the word that they had given to this hypothetical bit in the brain that would represent a piece of learning. And it's understandable that people thought that there would be a specific site for a specific piece of knowledge, because everything else works that way, you know. If you put food in the pantry or items in a box or whatever, they're located in space. And after a number of years of research, Carl Lashley reported somewhat sardonically that he had proved that learning is not possible. Because they would train rats. Now, those of you who are strongly anti-vivisectionists, plug your ears. Because this is not nice, but these little these little creatures, I guess, gave their lives that we might understand this. They trained rats to do mazes and to perform in certain ways for rewards. And then they would damage their brains to try to find out at what point the rat couldn't do the trick anymore. And what they found is that so long as the rat could drag its little body through the maze, it didn't forget the maze, no matter what they did. And this was really strange, because it began to look more like memory got like sprayed around into the brain like a deodorant rather than stored in a particular place. And that knowledge had kind of haunted Carl Lashley and Carl Pribram, who had worked for Lashley for a while. And so it occurred at some point when the hologram was successfully built, one of the things that was a curiosity about it was really... Oh, that's okay. That's okay. We'll find another chair. We'll take Ringo's chair. Thanks, Thomas. One of the things that's interesting about the hologram is that every part of the plate of the hologram, Michael can give you a better sense of how a hologram is made, but if you broke it, every piece of the hologram contains the whole picture. As Carl Pribram put it, it's not like if you had a photograph of your family, a normal photograph of your family, and you tore your sister off the corner, your sister would definitely be off the corner in that picture. But if you tore a corner off and it were, if you broke a corner off and it were a hologram, then whatever remained still would include your sister, would still be there. So Carl had talked about this, and I was vaguely aware of this theory. As I said, I knew that he had put it forth as, and he wasn't saying everything in the brain worked that way. But this one evening in Texas, he came to a part of the talk he had given before, but it didn't sink in. But I'd had enough coffee that night, I think, that I went, oh. And I'll back up just a minute into Carl's life and tell you how he came to this. He says, one night he was standing up in front of an audience in Minnesota somewhere, and he was talking to the people, and he was telling them the holographic model, And all of a sudden, this idea fell into his head. What if they're holograms? What if I'm a hologram? What if we're just all holograms looking at holograms? And then, not too long after that, he was telling his son his idea. And his son remarked, in fact, I think the goofy thing is, I think that Carl was performing an operation, neurosurgery, and his son was in the operating room, and as he was operating, he was talking about this theory. And his son said, well, that's interesting. You should know David Bohm. And I imagine there are a number of you here who know the work of the physicist David Bohm or have heard of him. And David Bohm had begun speaking of the holonomic universe. But holonomic was the term that he used, wasn't it, Mike, or not?
No, he just said that the universe was like a hologram.
Uh-huh.
Holonomic, I think, is Van Gogh.
Oh, okay, well, that's holotropic.
Oh, right, holotropic.
Okay. Well, Pilgrim is using holonomic these days. But anyway, he had compared the universe to a hologram. So Carl realized that David Bohm had invited him to a meeting and he hadn't answered the invitation. So the two of them got together from there. Well, anyway, when he was telling this that night, and he said, and maybe we're holograms, and so on and so forth. And all of a sudden, I realized why he was excited about it. That if he was right about this, that you don't have to go anywhere to try to explain the so-called paranormal phenomena. You know, because you're already dealing with something that is in a whole different ballpark. And that a lot of what had slowed us down was to try to figure out how to get from here to there. But if we've been fundamentally wrong about the nature of things, then that just, in some ways, even though it's complex, it simplified everything. And I got excited about it, and I wrote a special issue of my newsletter, Brain Mind Bulletin. I remember the date, it was July 4th, 1977, because the July 4th part of it tickled me. And it became a lot of people, because a lot of the people who read the bulletin were interested in spiritual matters, think that there were a lot of people who sort of jumped on it. There were times that Carl was happy that they had done that, and probably times that he was embarrassed. But he's now at the point, all these years later, where I think he's really grateful that it was the people, in a sense, who had a feel for the spiritual who got what it was that he was talking about, and he feels validated in that. Everybody who is here tonight has had some pretty freewheeling thoughts about the nature of things, and so I would like to introduce the panel. We have Michael Talbot, and Michael is, as I said, the author of the new book, The Holographic Universe, and 9 other books. What was it? Crop Rotation. Michael writes a novel and a nonfiction and a novel and a nonfiction. And I said, that explains why you're such a good storyteller. The Holographic Universe is a really beautiful book. He did a wonderful job on that. Pete Russell, who is second from my right, wrote The Global Brain and the TM... Was TM book?
I never get the TM
technique. I never get the title right. The Brain book and The Creative Manager. And Pete has just finished a new book and has a really exciting theory that pushes the envelope a bit further, which he will give us some inklings of tonight. And Pete is very kindly filling in for Tim Leary a strange non-coincidence. I happened to be with Pete in Ireland last week and knew that he was going to be here and said, could you come down to San Jose and be on the panel? And he kindly agreed to do that. And so I really thank Pete for showing up.
Coincidence is always happy in Ireland.
That's right. Wherever we are, they happen, Pete. Pete and I have known each other since before I wrote the holographic issue of the Brain Mind Bulletin. It seems like we always discover we're doing kind of parallel work. Fred Allen Wolfe wrote Time, Space, and Beyond and a number of other books. What are some of the titles, Fred?
Taking the Quantum Leap, Star Wave, The Body Quantum, Parallel Universes, and now a new book, The Eagle's Quest.
Which is a shamanic, a physicist wait a minute, shamanic physics, right? Do you like it? I think this could be an important new genre of books. And Robert Anton Wilson, of Illuminati fame, and many of you have read the Illuminati trilogy, probably. And what are some of the other things you've done besides your newsletter and all that good stuff?
Cosmic Trigger 1, Cosmic Trigger 2, the Schrodinger's Cat trilogy, The Widow's Son, The Earth Will Shake, Wilhelm Reich in Hell, and about 18 others.
These guys are so prolific, it just makes me sick. I take 7 years to write a book, or 4 years, or something like that. And anyway, we have some fun in mind for you tonight, and we hope to surprise ourselves. And if you have questions as we go along, go ahead and raise your hand. If the speaker is not too much in the middle of things, well, actually, I'll try to recognize you. You know, it's like, oh yeah, I see you. I remember you. I'll try to do it. If I don't, it's probably in connection with just trying to keep things moving. But since I'm opening it to questions from the floor, try to keep them really brief, okay? And I'll ask the panelists to try to answer the question and then sort of get back on the track, because we do want to move in a particular direction. What we're going to do is we're going to talk about things from this holographic perspective. Michael will give us a kind of an introduction to the concepts and whatever he feels appropriate. We'll talk about it a bit in terms of how you take a scientific theory, be it a feeling for quantum realities or whatever, and how you can kind of get the feeling for it in your own life. You don't have to understand it in a linear way to get the feeling of rightness, and we can talk about that. And then what we would like to do is to at some point we will move into discussing appropriate nonviolent methods for overthrowing cultural realities you don't like. Okay, so Michael, would you hear? Do you want to, wherever you want to be? Okay.
Can I have this in here, though?
Oh yeah, you can. I was trying to think about getting
handing
moving around, right?
Well, someone wants to hand it over.
Yeah.
First thing that I want to just say very briefly is the reason that I got interested in the holographic idea, and that's because I've lived a very unusual life and experienced a lot of things that really didn't fit with the standard scientific paradigm. So I've always been very scientifically oriented and wanted to understand things in scientific terms. Just two quick things. I grew up in a house where there was a poltergeist haunting. As many of you probably know, poltergeist is a German word for noisy ghost. And it's a haunting that doesn't seem to be associated with any traumatic experience of the death of a person. There are no apparitions that appear. It's more of a psychokinetic thing where things get thrown around and lots of noise and lots of stomping. And this haunting, it would throw pots and pans around glasses. It would rain gravel down on the roof at night. And my parents are very simple people. They didn't immediately attribute this to anything paranormal. It took quite a few years before we were then convinced that it was something supernatural, and quite a few years after that before I started becoming versed in what poltergeists were all about and the sort of parapsychological literature on them, and started figuring out that this thing was a psychic thing, not a ghost or an apparition. And the going theory is that they're created by poltergeists almost always surround people, not places, and the going theory is that they're unconscious manifestations of some person. And it seemed to have been an unconscious manifestation of me, in the sense that number one, it followed me wherever I moved after I moved away from the house. and number two, it manifested in a way that always seemed to mirror what was going on inside me emotionally and psychologically. Most of the time, it was just a sort of mischievous force, and would toss things around. But if I got into any sort of dark moods, it would become very dark and do malevolent things. And if I was in a happy mood, it would do happy things. And it seemed to possess a very rudimentary intelligence. If I asked it to respond or say something, it would give a knock, but it couldn't answer questions, really. It was more almost like a dog, the intelligence of a dog. But the reason I bring it up, just aside from the fact that it challenged the sort of sticks and stones world I was learning about in science class, was that a couple of the things that it did were really profound challenges to reality, not the least of which was that occasionally it would materialize objects out of thin air. And I saw a couple of these happen, and although the poltergeist activity really sort of dwindled when I was in my early 20s and hasn't really been around since, I have seen a number of other things that are of the same ilk that are grave challenges to our standard picture of reality. I'll mention just one other. When a few years back, I was going through a very difficult time in my life, and I guess it could be summed up that I was sort of in need of a miracle at that point. And my mother and my sister were visiting me in my apartment in New York. They're from the Midwest. And I have a little golden jade Buddha on my desk. And my mother had given me the Buddha. And she picked it up while I was standing beside her. And she looked at it and she said, "Oh, I remember giving you this Buddha." And as we were looking at the Buddha, all of a sudden, there was this little explosion of red light. A little sphere of red light expanded around the Buddha. And a red stone appeared in the middle of its forehead. And because it sounds kind of strange, but I'm sort of used to unusual things happening, and I thought, oh, well, it's kind of the universe saying, don't lose faith in the miraculous, you know, at this rough time in my life. My mother, poor thing, she is not used to these things, even though she experienced a lot of these things, and I looked at her kind of wondering how she was going to respond, or if she was even going to register having seen it. And she was just sort of staring down at the Buddha, and she said, "Gosh, I don't remember that ruby being there." I said, "But Mom, didn't you just see something unusual?" She said, "Well, it seemed like there was a little burst of light." And I said, "Yeah, and it seemed like it just sort of appeared out of nowhere." And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, that can't be. That just can't be." And my sister had handled this Buddha a lot and had seen it a lot. And she called my sister in. And unfortunately, I wanted her to show the Buddha to my sister without saying anything, but my mother was too excited. She said, "Look, was that stone there?" And before I could stop her, my sister looked at her, she said, "No, when did the stone get in this Buddha?" So there was pretty compelling evidence to me yet again that the world is not as we were taught in Mr. Wizard Science Show. And that is why I was so interested in the holographic idea. Marilyn has told you a little bit about the holographic idea. I can just add some things about Pribram's work. As she mentioned, what led Pribram into exploring or developing the idea was that no one could find a precise location of memory in the brain. Now, the brain does seem to have localized function, like motor skills seem to be localized in the brain. I'm sure you've all seen maps that say, here's where we know this is located, and here's where that's located. But I think even this gets to be kind of a complex and subtle issue, in that there are instances, for example, there are cases in severe epilepsy where it's been necessary to perform a hemispherectomy and remove half of the hemisphere of a person's brain. And one instance in particular, which was written about by Richard Restack, who's the neurologist who wrote the companion books to The Brain and the Mind, the two series on PBS, involved a woman who, after she had half of her brain removed, really didn't suffer any dysfunction. And now, you know, the one side of her brain controls one side of the body and the other controls the other side of the body, one would expect her to be paralyzed. And indeed, sometimes, you know, people with injuries most definitely are paralyzed and things like this happen. But as I say, there are exceptions to the rule that suggest that something more subtle and mysterious is going on. And again, maybe this holographic idea plays into this. Probably an even more extraordinary challenge to this notion that function can be located in the brain in the same way that cities can be located on a map involves the work of a pediatrician in England named John Lorber. And Lorber is one of his specialties is hydrocephalus. People who have hydrocephalus or water on the brain. And he, a young man was sent to him, an Oxford College student who was a mathematician student, had above normal IQ. And his physician had noticed that his head was oversized. And when he asked the student about this, the student said, "Well, I had hydrocephalus as a child, they put a shunt, a drain, in my brain, and they drained it off, and it saved my life." And he said, "Well, maybe you should go see Lorber, just make sure that things are still okay." And Lorber did a non-invasive brain scan of the guy and discovered that he didn't have a brain. That he didn't have his skull was filled basically with cerebrospinal fluid. He did have 1 millimeter brain tissue, which, as most of you probably know, is like about the width of a pencil lead, lining his skull, but he didn't have a brain. Now, again, if function is located in the brain the same way that things are located in a map, how on earth do we explain these sorts of things? And so it's clear that, you know, these are anomalies that have to be looked at. Now, Marilyn mentioned David Bohm, a physicist who also plays into this, the holographic idea. Bohm was drawn to the holographic idea from a completely different direction. He was studying subatomic reality. I'm sure all of you have heard of twins, stories of identical twins, where when one twin is hurt, the other feels the pain, that sort of thing. And it's been discovered, or initially it was just predicted in quantum physics, that there were, in certain subatomic processes, pairs of particles would be produced that were kind of like these identical twins that would have these mysterious connections. And Bohm, when this first came out, Einstein, this was first predicted decades ago, and Einstein said, well, this can't be, because if they could be instantaneously connected, that violates the speed of light, because it suggests that something is perhaps passing back and forth between them instantaneously, which Einstein said was not possible because nothing could travel faster than the speed of light. If it could, it would, among other things, probably mean that we could transcend the time barrier, which Einstein thought was an unacceptable picture of reality. But David Bohm started looking at this and wondering if there were perhaps another way of thinking about it. He developed another explanation for how these particles could be connected, and I should point out that although it took several decades, finally in 1982, a French team of physicists performed an experiment that demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt that these interconnections do occur. Although some physicists get very upset if you call them interconnections, and they use all kinds of euphemisms because they don't. If you call it a connection, you're sort of suggesting that there's a causal link between the two particles. And since most physicists feel that's not possible, they choose all kinds of words. From some physicists call them correlations between the particles, and my favorite is a physicist at Boston University named Albert Scheimany, who says he calls it passion between particles. Calling it passion between particles, you know, it sort of keeps it low key enough that you don't have to worry too much about the challenge to reality that this poses. Now, Marilyn had mentioned that the interesting thing about a hologram is that, you know, if you take a hologram and cut it in half, each half contains a whole image. Now, this is not true of the hologram like the one that Fred showed. It's only true of those that are encoded in a piece of photographic film, so that you have to shine a laser through the film to get the image reconstructed. One thing that I often say in talks when I'm talking about the holographic idea, because this is such a mind-boggling concept that people start to, you know, get a little breathless when they think about it, but really, we all have an example of this in our everyday lives of a sort of holographic type organization, and that involves television. You know, if you're watching, say, Johnny Carson on your TV set, you know that the image on your TV set comes from the radio waves that are permeating the room. And yet you wouldn't say, okay, where in the room is Johnny Carson? Because wherever you put the TV set, you're going to tune into the whole image, because every portion of those interfering radio waves in that room contain the whole image. So that's another way that you can kind of think about it, that what's going on in a hologram that makes it a little easier. Well, Bohm, when he saw these particles that, you know, the suggestion these particles were connected or had passion or whatever you want to say, he started thinking, well, maybe it isn't something passing back and forth between the particles. And when he discovered this concept of this, of the part in every, the whole in every part in the hologram, he thought that maybe this is a possible explanation. That basically, say if you have two electrons that seem to be interconnected this way, maybe the reason that you can look at one and get information about the other is if the universe is a kind of hologram, that means that everything in the universe contains information about the whole. Everything contains the whole in some sense. So if you look at one electron and get information about another, maybe because it's holographic and you're seeing information about the whole because it's contained there, or as the poet William Blake put it, you could find the universe in a grain of sand. Now, it's interesting, I mean, the holographic idea is, of course, a very controversial idea, and one pales when one to try to think of what sort of experiment could be set up to prove whether it's true or not. It's been criticized a lot for that, although I think Bohm argues passionately, and I think he's right, that not all ideas that can be, that some ideas that can't be proven may still have some worth. And in fact, one of the blind spots in science, I think, is this notion of proof, because science is sort of riddled with metaphysics, but just kind of ignores the fact of, you know, I'm sure you've all heard of the Big Bang Theory, but can you fathom an experiment that could be set up to prove or disprove whether the Big Bang occurred? And there are all kinds of scientific ideas that you can't prove, but nonetheless have use, and I think the holographic idea falls into this category. Now, but it's compelling to me, as I'm sure it is to everyone on this panel, that here are two areas where if the brain seems to have these holographic properties and reality seems to be structured like a hologram, when you put these together, this is kind of unusual. Just one other quick thing I'd like to mention about Pribram is that Pribram became aware of, that from the research of others, that the brain also uses the same mathematics to decipher perception, a kind of mathematics known as Fourier mathematics, that as are involved in the making of a hologram. So here is yet another suggestive element. It's not proof, but it's very suggestive of something, you know, that there's maybe something holographic going on. Now, as I say, if you put these two together, that the brain, that we have brains that seem to be programmed to decipher something holographic, and reality seems to be structured in a similar way to a hologram, it does suggest that maybe in a grain of sand is perhaps literally true, that each of us, in fact, each of our cells, each of our neurons, each of the protons in our body, the electrons, etc., each of the quarks even, contains in some semblance the entire universe. And this holographic idea, in my mind, has sort of three broad areas of implication. And one that Marilyn has already mentioned is in the world of psychic phenomena. And that's because of this sort of notion of interconnectedness, that the idea, you know, if telepathy or things like psychic phenomena are real, that one person can access information in another person's mind, our first way of thinking about that is, well, how could my mind get information from your mind? What is the signal or the transfer? And yet again, if we look at Bohm's explanation of what's going on in these particles, it's not a transfer. It's because every particle contains the whole. And it may be that we can get information from things that seem to be external to us, not because we're reaching out and pulling them in, but because we each contain the whole in some sense. So it's already inside our heads. And that's what makes it so less so much less of a problem. Now, I was intrigued, and another reason that I wrote this book, The Holographic Universe, is because so many people have sort of taken this idea and run with it. Just one fellow, as I'm sure a lot of you are aware of his work, is Stanislav Grof, who is one of the founders of the field of transpersonal psychology. Now, Grof discovered that when people are in altered states, they appear to be able to access all kinds of information that could not come to them through normal sensory means. One of my favorite examples is he had a woman who he was doing LSD research in a therapeutic setting, and she was hallucinating, or allegedly hallucinating, on this LSD, and she had changed to a giant lizard, she thought, and she thought that Dr. Grof had changed to a giant lizard, and she said, "I have to tell you, there's a colored patch on the side of your neck that is really turning me on sexually." And Dr. Grof dutifully wrote this down in his notes, thought, "Well, that's interesting," and he got to thinking about it, and he asked, it bothered him why it seemed like such an odd thing for her to come up with, and so he asked her, we don't know, I mean, she thought she was a dinosaur, kind of prehistoric lizard, and of course we don't know what the skin of prehistoric lizards, what the color patterning was, but he asked an expert in reptiles about this, and the expert said, "Well, that's amazing, because there are lizards that do have their sexual cueing system by these colored patches in the neck," and so he thought that was quite compelling, that this was some accurate information. And if you read any of Grof's work, you discover that there are all kinds of very startling pieces of information that people are able to access. Another of my favorite examples is he had a fellow who found himself in what he said he sensed intuitively was a part of reality where people who had committed suicide went. And he said he couldn't see the people, but he could sense their presence all around him, these sort of energy presences. And one came up to him and started to speak to him sort of telepathically and said, "You know, I want you to tell my parents I'm all right. They're very disturbed. Here's their phone number." Gave him the phone number, and Grof called the phone number, you know, curious about this after the session was over, and discovered that this family to whom the phone number belonged had a son who had just recently committed suicide. So Grof has taken the holographic idea and said maybe that we should look at this quite literally, this interconnectedness bit. That, you know, that we each contain the whole in some sense and can access information that our normal scientific paradigms is just impossible for us to access. The second area that's, I think, one of the most important things in the holographic idea has to do with the Pribram's assertion that we don't respond to reality, only a sort of model of reality. An example of this, there's a study done by a few years back by an Israeli psychologist, and he took soldiers and he divided them up into groups, and all the groups marched 25 miles, but none of the soldiers were told how far they were marching. Some were told that they were marching 10 miles, even though in actuality they were set on a 25-mile march. Some were told they marched 35 miles, and some were told the truth, that they were marching 25 miles. And then they did physiological studies after this march, and they discovered that physiologically their bodies responded not to the reality of what they'd marched, but to what they'd been told. That they were responding more, their bodies reacted more to the model of reality that they had inside their head than to the actual reality that had transpired. And there are many, many instances of this. I mean, the Russians have taken this and used it in their sports training. They've had people practice basketball in their mind and things like this, you know, and others, lots of people, not only the Russians, are doing this, and with quite remarkable results. Now, Pribram says that this fact that, you know, what's out there in a sense, if you think of this television analogy that I brought up earlier, where you know you're watching Johnny Carson on your TV set, right there you have an example of a reality of two forms. One is that concrete form where you see Johnny Carson on the TV set, but the other is this energy form, which has this holographic organization, and that's the, you know, the radio waves that are permeating the living room. Well, Primrum has said, you know, and this was what Marilyn was alluding to when he said, "What if we're all holograms? These are not his words, this is my analogy, but what if we're, you know, kind of like conscious TV sets, and what we see is the image like the image on the TV set, but what's out there isn't Johnny Carson in our living room, like when we're watching TV, but it's really just an ocean of energy, an ocean of frequencies. Maybe we really are embedded in a hologram in a sense, and what happens to reality then? Even if this isn't the case, it's quite clear that, as I say, we do respond to our models of reality, sometimes in a more potent way than our actual reality. One area that I think this has really quite amazing implications is in the realm of healing and visualization. There's a woman named Jean Achterberg who was fundamental in helping Carl Simon come up with this whole thing of visualizing, you know, the immune system and healing to assist in the healing process. And she has used the holographic idea to say, well, here's another example where perhaps, you know, what's important isn't the reality, but our model of reality. So when people start to visualize that they're getting well, they do get well sometimes, or at least assist in them getting well. And it's clear, I mean, if you examine the evidence on healing and miracles, that something extraordinary is taking place. I'll give you just two quick examples that I talk about in the book that I think are really good evidence that this is true. There are many, I mean, there are hundreds of them that you can find if you read the literature on it. One is involves a man who had lymphatic cancer. He had tumors the size of oranges all throughout his body. And he heard about a new chemotherapy, and he said to his doctor, "You've got to give me this new drug. I've heard wonderful things about it." Well, the doctor said to him, "This drug takes several weeks to take effect, and frankly, I think you've only got a couple of days left to live." And the fellow said, "No, please, please, you've got to give it to me." So the doctor gave it to him, and within 3 days, his tumors melted away, as the doctor put it, like snowballs in a hot stove. Well, he got out of the hospital, was fine. A couple months later, he read an article saying this chemotherapy wasn't as good as he thought it was. Boom, 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 his tumors came back. The doctor started to figure out something unusual was going on. He said, he lied to the man. He said, "Listen, those reports are wrong. This drug is very potent. In fact, I have an even more potent version of it." He injected the man with just salt water. The man's tumors melted away again. Boom, boom, boom. They're gone. Well, then, a couple months later, final reports come out of the drug saying it's absolutely worthless. The man's tumors returned. Unfortunately, this time he died. But here again is another example where the man was not responding to reality, quote-unquote. He thought he was getting a potent drug, and that made him believe that he was being healed by the drug. But what was really happening was that his model of reality had more control over his body than actual reality. And in fact, it suggested that he at least, and perhaps all of us, have this enormous latent healing capacity that we don't access. One other quick example of this that I think is awfully fascinating, there was a study of a new chemotherapy in England where they gave the people, they took a group of cancer patients, they divided them into two groups, and they didn't tell who was getting the real drug and who was getting the placebo. But they told all the people, "This is a very toxic drug, may cause you to lose your hair." Well, 30% of the people receiving the placebo lost their hair. So again, here's an instance where it wasn't reality that was causing them to lose their hair, it was their model of reality. And I think we've got to really sort of incorporate this knowledge into our practical lives, which we don't. If you aren't fortunate enough to have to go on chemotherapy, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a doctor who says, "Oh, by the way, this drug will cause you to lose your hair," especially if you believe it will. And we have to, I believe in orthodox medical treatment, but I think we have to really start to incorporate some of the things we're learning about human potential and ability into these things. Now, the third area of implication that I'll close with is that, again, getting back to this notion that if we are like conscious television sets and there's, you know, out there is only a sea of energy, it's kind of that's a metaphysical statement. In a sense, we're so deeply entrained to think that there's a reality out there, it's difficult even for those of us who are very liberal in our thinking to imagine that could be. And yet, it's clear also that the belief in a reality out there is just as metaphysical, because if we can create a model of reality in our heads and all respond to it, we can never prove that there's something out there. Belief in a reality out there may in fact be the ultimate metaphysical assumptions, although we don't really look at it that way. And if you examine the literature on sort of miraculous events, there are powerful suggestions that reality is a lot different than we really think about. just a couple. One, Bernadette Subaru, the little girl who saw the Virgin at Lourdes, the vision of the Virgin at Lourdes, was watched once by a group of people, including her family physician, when she lapsed into a meditative state to drop her hand into a candle flame, and she held her hand in the full of the flickering flame for 10 minutes. And then when she came out of her trance, she moved her hand, and she was completely unburned. Well, you know, we're taught you stick your hand in a candle flame for 10 minutes, you get severely burned. And, you know, what becomes of reality if these things are possible? At some deeply unconscious level, we can access these abilities. Tomorrow in my talk, my workshop, I'll go into these a little more depth, but I'm just giving you some brief taste of them now so that we can get on to some of the other subjects. A second example involved a wonder worker in Ceylon named Mohadi. This was written about by Gilbert Grosvenor, the head of the National Geographic Society magazine. And Mohadi, for reasons particular to his own beliefs, had decided that he had to sort of sacrifice himself once a year to this Ceylonese god named Katara Gama. Well, again, for reasons peculiar to his own religious faith, he decided that the best way to honor his god was to have these grappling hook buried in his back once a year, and he dragged around this huge stone sledge. Well, as Grosvenor and his National Geographic team watched and photographed, he did this, no blood. They removed the hooks, no wounds. Now, again, this is pretty startling. How can, you know, something like this happen? And I would like to suggest that maybe we are, holograms in the truest sense of the word, that there's far more plasticity to the world than any of us maybe have dared imagine. One last example, and my favorite, that, again, I'll talk about at greater length tomorrow, is that it involves a religious group in the early 1700s in France called the Jansenists. And it's interesting to me that not a lot of people know about the Jansenist situation. Basically, what was going on is that King Louis XV was Catholic, and the Jansenists called themselves Catholic, but they're really Protestants masquerading as Catholics. And the church and King Louis didn't like this at all. And so, but they also, their hands were kind of tied because the Jansenists were very wealthy, very politically powerful. And they wanted to wipe the Jansenists out, but they knew they couldn't. But the upshot was that this was a very tense political situation. One of the Jansenist leaders died, and the Jansenists started gathering. This was in Paris, in his tomb. They started gathering in his tomb. And this really bothered Louis and the Pope, because there were all these you know, religious heretics, in their view, massing. And the Jansenists were worried that at any moment they might be attacked by Louis, and they started going into these sort of religious convulsions and trance-like states. And in this sort of emotionally tense atmosphere, they started to perform very miraculous things. And what is significant about the Jansenist miracles is that they were investigated by emissaries from the church who wanted desperately for this to not be happening, that wanted to disprove this. And even the church investigators, after investigating, said, "My God, this is happening." And basically what happened is that the Jansenists, when they were in these convulsion states of trance, could not be hurt. They could be hit by sledgehammers, you know, stabbed with knives, swords, even hatchets, and they couldn't be hurt, they couldn't be cut. Some of them could even stick their heads in roaring bonfires and not be burned. And this is, if this is true, what becomes of reality? And what's another significant thing about this is that this was no flash in the pan set of phenomena. This went on, the Jansenist miracles went on for over 2 decades and involved tens of thousands of people constantly gathering in this particular area of France. Now, I mention these things not because I'm interested in anomalies for anomalies' sake, because they're strange or anything, but because I think we always have to look at these things and say, well, what do they teach us in the here and now that can help us in reality, you know? And as I say, I'll talk about this more tomorrow, especially in my workshop.
I've got 2 sentences left, right. Marilyn.
But this... You know, if the holographic idea could be taken to this level, what does this mean for us in our everyday lives? You know, what are the limitations? I mean, should we believe in limitations, or to what extent is reality plastic, and what is possible? And with that, I'll hand the mic over.
What, you caught me unaware. Thanks, Michael. That's dizzying. The Jansenists, especially. It made me think about the time when my youngest child was about, I guess, 1.5 or 2 years old. She was in her high chair, and her siblings had been doing that thing that little kids do of, like, put your finger through the flame, but first you get it wet. And so there was a candle right in front of her. And she didn't realize that they had wetted their fingers. So she was just putting her little finger in the flame, like that, very slowly. And I started to say, you know, don't do that, you'll burn yourself. And I realized that that was not the thing to say. So I watched for a while and couldn't stand it and moved the candle. Had I heard this story, I wouldn't have worried at all. It was me I did it for, not her. That was, you got in, however long that took, a pretty complete sense of what the hologram and the possibilities that the models are all, a model is all about. And since we started a little late, I don't think they're going to chase us out of the room. Does anybody know? Is there any official person in here? We'll just assume they aren't. Okay, Hugo's going to find out. So we
have
kind of
2 hours.
Okay, check our timing. Is there anything that, no, if we ask questions at this point of Michael, it could be too complicated. Yeah.
Yeah, when we talk about the whole, the universe being so plastic and reality is different than we think, wouldn't it be, I'm addressing it to you, Michael, couldn't it be that these things could be explained in some other fashion? For example, if it is Deuces Wild, then perhaps people that reported this were hypnotized and they didn't see this actually happening, especially in 1700s. There's a lot of other explanations that are more compatible with reality. Believe me, I'm here because I'm interested in this, but we have to look at these other types of aspects.
I think that rather than have Michael answer that question, that is too open-ended the question, but it's going to come up with some of the other things that are brought up.
I hope so, yeah.
Is that okay? I mean, because I would have like about 72 answers to your question already myself, you know, or things I would want to say or bring up or ask you in connection with it. You can't have thought about the weird stuff this many years, as I think we've all been doing, without having thought around it from a lot of different directions. So I think it'll come up with what some of the other people have to say. Is that okay with everybody?
Yeah. Certainly, okay. The news is that we can go anywhere.
We can do
it. Yeah. Yesterday they went up to 10:15, but then again,
you're going to run out of tape. Okay. Yeah. So we'll try to. We can go on beyond the tape, but it'd be nice to make it come out like a nice, smooth production. Yes.
I would like to ask Michael what happened to a guy who didn't have a brain. When Michael told him that Paul wasn't lost, he could run for president.
I know an answer. The guy was a beanhead, right?
That's what it means, Finn.
On that subject, I don't want to belabor it because we don't have much time, but it's really fascinating. I got two questions. One is, I mean, did he have like a brainstem left? And two is, where would I find that written up?
The Brain Mind Bulletin covered that. And I saw it the other day, coincidentally. If you drop me a note, I'll give you the references on it. Or Michael may have it in the back of the book.
Not in this book. My book, Beyond the Quantum, I talk about. Give references from Science Magazine.
There actually were other hydrocephalics found. That one was the most amazing situation, but there have been some others found who didn't. It's funny that more people didn't get shook up by that.
Well, there were a number of people who just said, nope, didn't happen, can't be. So.
He was hypnotized. Okay. Okay. I think that since we kind of covered that outrageous point of view, that it might be appropriate, Pete, if you introduce us to your outrageous but very logical model.
Of course. Can I do it? Maybe I'll come up.
What about this thing? What is this microphone for?
Can you stand there and talk about it?
Is this the whole graphic microphone? What is this one?
That's for the tape. But if you'd stand there and talk about it, it'd be great because then Ringo can get some.
This is really looking at how Michael's been talking about the universe is interconnected. David Bohm was looking a lot at how the universe is interconnected. And I've just been looking a lot the last few years about some very interesting implications from Einstein's theory on the special theory of relativity about the interconnectedness of the universe. Closer. And it also relates to this experiment that was conducted in France. We had particles going in completely different directions, which seemed to be in contact.
Yeah?
And... and it's all to do with light. But it didn't happen on cue, but it reminded me.
Close.
Very briefly, a 30-second potted course on the special theory of relativity as an introduction. Two things Einstein said was, all frames of reference are equally valid. You cannot say that one frame of reference is more important, more basic. I mean, if you're travelling along in a train, that frame of reference is just as valid as standing still. Travelling near the speed of light is just as real as standing still. Even travelling at the speed of light, and this is the important thing, is just as real as standing still. And the second thing he said was, the speed of light is absolute. However fast you're going, the speed of light always passes at the same speed. Even if you're travelling 99.9% the speed of light, light would still go past you at the speed of light. Right? It's weird, I know. And that's why a lot of people find it difficult to get into relativity. But now some very interesting things came out of Einstein's work. The faster you go, the slower time goes. And also the shorter you become. And also the heavier you become. And at the speed of light, you'd become infinitely heavy, which would mean you'd actually have to take an infinite amount of energy to get to the speed of light, which is why nothing can travel at the speed of light, because it would take an infinite amount of energy. Light travels at the speed of light because it has no mass, so it can travel at the speed of light. Now, the interesting things that happen is when you look at the universe from the point of view of light itself. Now, physics doesn't normally do this, because it says, since nothing can travel at the speed of light, we don't have to bother about it. Because when you fill in the equations for the speed of light, they become filled with infinities and zeros, and nothing makes sense. And so the normal view of physics is, forget it. Because no observer can travel at the speed of light, so it doesn't matter. But light travels at the speed of light. And in many ways, light is more fundamental to the universe than us. Michael was talking about reality. I mean, this physical reality that we think we see is all just a creation in our own mind. The thingness you're talking about, things are really just in our own mind. We have no idea what is out here. Probably just a pure energy field interacting at the speed of light. And in that sense, the speed of light is probably more real than all the stuff we create in our minds. So now if you start looking at the universe from light's point of view, it gets very interesting, and it's similar in some ways to what the holographic models say. From light's point of view, you take a photon, we'll come around to photons in a minute, you take a photon, call it a photon, travelling from that light to my eye. Me in the physical world says it takes, whatever, about 100 millionths of a second, 100 millionths of a second to travel the 10 feet or whatever. From light's point of view, that's not the case at all. From light's point of view, the universe is bent, and for an instant, that light bulb and the retina of my eye are in contact. Because it takes no time and it travels no distance at the speed of light. Light never actually travels anywhere. We think it does, stuck here in our physical material illusion. We think that light travels from A to B. From light's point of view, there is a point of emission and a point of absorption, which are the same. And this isn't new, this was pointed out way back in a paper in 1926, and no one quite knew what to do with it, and so they ignored it. David Bohm actually followed it up in about, was it just after the second, I think it was about the 40s or 50s, David Bohm followed up. But again, nobody knew quite what to do with it. It even means that if I look out at a distant star, way across the universe, or across our galaxy, we can't see much further than our galaxy, the point of emission of the photon that travels across the universe to my eye is the same as the point of absorption from the point of view of light. So any two points in the universe connected by a beam of light, from light's point of view, are actually coincident. They actually touch. And this is all very straightforward stuff that comes out of the special theory of relativity. So the universe is interconnected by every single ray of light that travels through the universe is a point of actual physical interconnection. And relativity talks this about the interval, what's called the space-time interval, is zero. There's no space-time separation between the beginning and end of a ray of light, which has some interesting implications. Because from light's point of view, if it didn't actually travel from that light to my eye, if the points were actually the same, it didn't need to be a photon or a wave. It's only in our physical reality that we have to argue whether it's actually a photon or a wave. As you probably know, there's this big conundrum in physics. If you measure light in some situations, it appears as a photon. Measure in other situations, it appears as a wave. Measure it from light's point of view, it's just no need. I never went anywhere. Why did I need to be a wave or a photon? All that happened was energy just went across an interface. But the other interesting thing is that the idea of the speed of light is constant. From light's point of view, of course, it travels nowhere in no time, so it has no speed. Doesn't need a speed. And if you look at it, what we observe as the speed of light is actually us stretching out the universe, stretching out this point of contact. We stretch out distance and we stretch out time in a constant ratio, which we observe as the speed, we call it the speed of light. It's actually a ratio of creation, of how space and time are created in a constant ratio. Now what's fascinating to me about this, and why I think it ties in with some of the holographic ideas, apart from the fact the whole interconnectedness of the universe, if you look at the universe from light's point of view, it's very, very similar to the universe from the point of view of mind. You could say there's almost two realms in physics. There's the realm of light, which doesn't travel anywhere, has no mass, and instantaneous. And there's the realm of matter, which we normally live in. You could draw the same parallel with us as human beings. There's our physical bodies, which travel around, have matter. And there's the realm of consciousness, mind, which doesn't have any matter, and which seems to be also timeless in a sense. And it's like the way that time works in the mind is very similar, almost exactly the same as the way time works in the realm of light. If, again, say you're looking at a star, physics says when you see that star, you're seeing that star as it was, say, 100 years ago. The light in this world took 100 years to reach us. In the physical world, if it took 100 years to reach us, physics tells us you saw that star as it was 100 years ago. Our experience isn't like that at all. We see that star now. Or if you look at the sun, you see the sun now. You don't see it conceptually 8 minutes ago. You see it now. The fact that it's 8 minutes in the past, what you're seeing, is just something that, some concept, some idea that physics tells us. So the reality of our own experience is this nowness that stretches across the universe. That the galaxy you see, or the stars you see in the distance, are in the same now as our own experience. And the same with light. The now of the light that went from the star to us is all in the same instant of time. So that instantaneous moment from the star to our eye that the photon experiences is the same instantaneous experience that happens in consciousness. And following this through, and I'm just giving a very quick survey now, but what seems to come out from all of this is that the whole realm of light, this whole interconnectedness of the universe through light, is very similar, so similar that it's almost exactly the same as the realm of mind as opposed to the realm of matter. And it's also interesting to see in language, we talk about the light of consciousness, the inner light. We use the words light very often for mind. And maybe the two, light and consciousness, are much, 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 much closer together than we normally think. And this is all stuff which is, say, being explored in progress, but it's stuff to play around with for tonight and onwards.
that intriguing? That's going to be in the book that Pete has been working on called, I guess it's still called, Now, the End of Time and the Beginning of Presence.
No, the English publishers just changed it.
Yes.
It's now called A White Hole in Time.
Yes.
Again.
Okay. Well, we don't know yet what it's going to be called. Okay. Don't anybody have thought?
Don't anybody know.
I would have to look at the
If you want to know later, if we get this tape together and edited and have it available and you want to know about it, pass up card or addresses or something. Will you do that? We'll let you know.
No, we will.
Russell.
Did you find that as exciting as I did? Isn't that neat? Like, now, whoever would have thought life from the point of view of life? But David Bohm actually told you that was that the guy in the 20s that somebody had once gotten a little interested in that idea and then didn't
develop it? Yeah. Well, the whole point that the point of emission and the point of absorption of a photon mm-hmm. are the same mm-hmm. from the photon's point of view mm-hmm. was explored, mm-hmm. but it wasn't taken much further.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Pete basically did this thing himself. And I think it's kind of neat to know, because those of us who've known him for some time, we know him as having such wide-ranging interests, but it's a little surprising to hear that he was tutored in physics when he was at Cambridge by Stephen Hawking.
I should point out, those aren't new ideas. There's at least two people I know of that have put forth the idea that light doesn't have speed. One is a guy named Marshall Smith, who's a sort of a gadfly engineer around here in the South Bay that put forth that idea, and there's another guy whose name I can't remember, so I won't mention him, but he's a former NASA employee that also came up with the idea that light doesn't have a speed, so it's not a new idea.
Oh no, I mean, it's obvious it comes out of Einstein's equations, and people saw that way back in the early 20s. It's been known, what is it, 70 years.
Yeah,
but it's the implications when you start looking in terms of consciousness and mind that I find fascinating.
That's what it was, me too. It was partly the idea of just somehow thinking of light from light's point of view. Because you don't think of light as having a point of view. And then remembering that classically, the analogy has always been made. We talk about enlightenment, and he saw the light, and so on. It tickles my...
Peter, could you address how that theory might relate to Penrose's twister theory and the idea that twisters via light can be the interface between higher dimensional reality and our four dimensional space-time?
No, I'm sorry.
Well, I think you got it. Thank you for the classic.
I think the question says it all.
That's good. Well, can't miss that way, right? Okay, yes. Peter Russell.
If light doesn't have a speed, the measurement that light goes 156,000 miles a second, what's being measured then?
Oh, light has a speed in our frame of reference.
Oh.
Not from from light's point of view, light has no speed. From our point of view, in the world of matter, light most certainly has a speed.
Do we have a speed from light's point of view?
Yes.
We're a little
yes,
slow.
We do.
Probably.
We're all moving backwards at 186,000 miles a second.
Light probably. Would you repeat that? Okay, that was pretty funny. Okay. So Michael said, do we have a speed from light's point of view? From light's point of view, what do we have a speed? And Pete said, we're going backwards. Come on. You did it once. Make it up again.
We're all going backwards at 186,000 miles a second.
Well, right as soon as I heard that, I had this image of light saying to itself, will they ever see me? Yes.
Would you please relate this to the tachyon hypothesis?
I've got to get you on this one.
Yeah.
They're after you.
Yes. Well, tachyons is the idea that if you start going faster than the speed of light, then a lot of the equations from the world of matter start having negatives in them, particularly you get negative mass. So faster than the speed of light, particles would have negative mass.
It's actually imaginary mass.
A square root of a negative.
Thank you. Imaginary. Actually, I think Fred's going to answer this question much better than me.
It's imaginary.
Imaginary mass.
You're doing fine, Peter.
Why don't we do this? Why don't you go ahead, answer the question, and then kind of launch into your.
Launch into it. Okay. Right. Okay. I'm going to launch.
Here I go.
This is going launch time.
This is like pick a paradigm, you guys.
Right. Well, tachyons are very bizarre. First of all, no one's ever observed one, but I'm not sure we've observed the first electron yet, and I'm still not convinced that the first human has arrived on the planet yet either. But we'll keep looking, folks. You know, I'm not sure. Anyway, tachyons, yes, in the equations of the mathematics which describe the physical phenomena called tachyons. The mass is an imaginary number. Those of you that are in my workshop now know what imaginary numbers are and what they had to do with this weirdness we call the quantum universe that we're all living in. Okay. Anyway, yes, and things are very reversed in the tachyonic worldview. Time becomes space and space becomes time. And I am convinced in my new book called The Eagle's Quest, I talk a little bit about what it's like to be a tachyon. I spent some time with the Peruvian shamans in the jungle doing ayahuasca, and I became one. You're looking at one now. Anyway, they don't realize how true this is, but
it's their reality.
Okay, well, you see, what's very interesting about all this thing about the hologram and the universe and all the stuff that we're dealing with here is one very interesting question. We are all talking as if we know exactly what we were talking about for one very good reason. Because we all think we know who it is that we are when we're talking. In other words, we all have a very clear idea that we are here in the first place. Or that there's an I that says, oh, I see, or I know, or from the point of view of, or as if there is something that we can call an I that sees and has points of view. And in the holographic model of the universe, we talk about holograms, maybe as Michael put it, seeing holograms. That's a wonderful idea. But the big question is, where is your I-ness, Your Highness? Now, I've spent a lot of time researching that question, okay? I've looked everywhere for mine, and I can't find it. So I don't know what type of problem this causes emotionally to not have an I-ness, but I really don't have one. And I've checked everywhere in the universe, and I haven't found one yet. The brain surgeons tell me that they can't find it, and the neurophysiologists tell me that they haven't found one. And when I ask people to point to their I-ness, they usually point, if they're Westerners, they point here. Some Japanese people point here. I know a few people I know that point here. And, so, I mean, it just kind of depends on, only those in front could see that. You're lucky, I mean. So, in other words, your I-ness doesn't seem to be really something that exists. So, what we're dealing with is a rather magical construct here. How does the I, which is the witness of the hologram, form? And I've come to the conclusion that the only way you could possibly answer that question is to look at the brain itself as holographic. So I started doing some research. Is it possible that the brain is a hologram? I mean, a real hologram. I mean, not just a metaphor, but a real hologram. So I checked and I found out that in Physical Review A, 1986-87, and Italian... You Italians are really... Where is Zaffarelli? Where is it?
Zuccarelli.
You guys, what? Zuccarelli, yeah. Okay, Zuccarelli. All right. Zaffarelli's a... Yeah. He's good too.
He's doing the filming.
He's doing the filming. You're doing the whole yard. You guys got to get together. You know, make a great movie. But I mean, it's the Italian Renaissance all over again. There's an Italian named Tiboli, who's a Tiboli. Yeah, not Tiboli. Tiboli, or maybe it's Nobili. Nobili, I think his name is Nobili. Nobili. Anyway, who is at a university? I think it's the old University of Padua where Galileo did his work. And he came out with a model of Schrödinger wave holography in brain cortex. Schrödinger waves are waves which are quantum mechanical waves, which I talked about in my talk today. Too bad most of you weren't there. Why weren't you there? I'm getting paranoid again. Okay. We were talking about Philip K. Dick, and one of my favorite writers, and with Robert. Okay. Anyway. So the point is, if that's true, then the brain, if the brain is a hologram, what kind of hologram is it? How does it actually operate? And so if you look at a hologram, one of the things that's very interesting about a hologram is that it's a two-dimensional surface through which you see a three-dimensional image of an object, which, for all intents and purposes, appears to be out there. Okay? Well, if the brain cortex is three-dimensional, except for this guy that's got a few millimeters, but most of ours are a little thicker than that. Not much, though. I don't think we have much more than that. Anyway, the cortex is like a thin rug covering the brain. If it is also a hologram, then it's a three-dimensional hologram. So I've reasoned the following way. It's a bit Tweedledum and Tweedledee, but it sort of goes like this. If two-dimensional holograms reconstruct three-dimensional images, then, ergo, it follows that three-dimensional holograms reconstruct
four-dimensional
images. See how simple it is? Okay. All right, great. So what is the heck is a four-dimensional image? Now, I've seen a peanut stand, I've seen a house fly, but I've never seen a four-dimensional image. At least I don't think I have. But well, I don't know. I mean, maybe on some drugs I've taken away. But So let's get, what could a four-dimensional image be? Well, let's get into what Peter is telling us. What does Einstein say the fourth dimension is? By the way, Einstein never said that. You know, he was his teacher, Hermann Minkowski, in 1908, who gave the first popular lecture on the theory of relativity, and then died the year after that. I don't know if there's a connection there or not. But after giving the first... He was the one who said that time is the fourth dimension. He was the one who came up with the whole idea of the geometry of space-time. Very, very brilliant. Even Einstein said, you made it easier for me to understand. I'm serious, Einstein said that. Okay, so if time is the fourth dimension, then we would say that what's being constructed in the brain is time. I mean, if the brain constructs three-dimensional images and time is the fourth dimension, then the time experience is being constructed in the brain. Well, how would that happen? I mean, what could a time experience be? Well, I remember going to, see, I spent 2 years with Bohm, and he influenced me. He drove me crazy. He used to come into my, I had an office right next to him at Birkbeck College. He used to come into my office, and he would tell me his latest theories. I never could understand the guy. But I enjoyed the fact that he felt that I was smart enough to understand what he was talking about. I mean, I don't think I was. But I really enjoyed the fact that he thought I was. I mean, you know, it's important what other people think about me, right? You know, I care what other people think.
That's Diamond. There he is.
Okay, yes, right. I'm speaking, yes, okay. All right, so I've lost track of what I was saying. I get so caught up in my own
experience. Don't worry.
That's right.
You rewind the tape.
What? No, you have to rewind the tape. Okay. But we're talking about the four-dimensional hologram. We're talking about where is the eye. So if relativity says that time is the fourth dimension, then how would that be experienced? And I came to the conclusion that the way that it would be experienced would be the eye presence. And here's what Bohm told me. He said, look, he said, what is time? And I said, I don't know, David, you got me. What is time, huh? and he would say, well, time is thought. And I said, well, that's true. I mean, if you think there's time, time is thought. So if time is something that the brain makes, then it figures out that if it's thought, well, then time might be the construction we call the ego or the eye sense of somebody being here, in here, somewhere. So time and I are the same thing, okay? So I time is your time, and my time is, you know, whatever that song goes like. Anyway, so it's, so time is I. And that means that moment to moment, what we call momentary experience, the way we see the four-dimensional hologram is by saying I. It's Carmen Miranda's show all over, and it's a continual. It's a, you got to be fast. I'm telling you, this is like the Mort Saul of the quantum realm. You know, you've got to pay attention because you know it goes by quickly. If I shave my beard, I even look like him. All right. So anyway, if you really get into this, then the time is I. So we have this continual process going on in which all we're doing is moving along a direction of this kind of 4D space and going, I. And those momentary flashes give us the separation of space of space and time. So this is how the I gets constructed, I think.
Therefore I am,
right. Okay. Yeah, you can ask me a question. Anybody can ask me a question. I'm not saying I'll answer, but you can ask.
Well, I don't know. I mean, this idea occurred to me, or whoever this was here, while you were talking, that I think that was kind of an intriguing idea, that it is the ego's remembering itself that causes the experience of time. Because then it occurred to me that maybe that would be why, when we are at our most egoless, we have no concern with time. Mm. And we seem to have plenty of it.
Yes. Well, as Einstein once put it, when you've got your tukas on a hot stove, 1 minute seems like an hour. But when you got your tukas next to your sweetie, what?
He gets to do one more thing, which will sum up, to actually sum this whole thing up. Okay, I want you to tell him the baseball story.
Oh, yes. Okay. Well, all right. We're talking about the quantum worldview. Okay, in the quantum worldview, there is. You see, you don't know where I'm coming from. This, you just think this is kind of a, you know, this is comic land. Folks, I'm a serious quantum physicist. I don't seem like it, but you study this long. What?
You say you're a serious quantum physicist.
Okay. I didn't have a drink yet either. It's good. Okay. All right. Yeah. It's this time of night. I just get delirious. All right. Anyway, if we get into this whole thing about quantum physics, there's this thing called the observer effect. In other words, when something, the world appears as a result of our participation with it, we observe and suddenly it's there. So the big question is, you know, what is that process? What is going on? So this reminds me of a story. There were three umpires, and they were standing around the baseball diamond arguing about how good it is to ump, or whether they're good umps or whatever. And the first ump was kind of a Newtonian ump. And he stood up before he did two umps, and he says, "I calls them as they are." The other two umps looked, and, yeah, okay. Second ump was kind of, I don't know, he's sort of middle row. One leg is Newtonian, their leg might be quantum, I don't know. And he would say, "Well, I call them as I see them." He's putting himself, you know, seeing is the important thing, right? But the third ump is pure quantum. He says, "They ain't nothing till I call them."
This is nice. You get kind of a smorgasbord, and everything you've heard up here is almost certainly true. Even the parts that contradicted each other. Yes.
Today, I thought maybe that my reality would be a challenge, but I didn't realize it would be challenged over in the downtown garage where I parked my car on the second level in the corner. When I went back after lunch, I went to look for my car, and it wasn't on the second deck, it was on the third.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering if I'd like to ask, is this a product of the poltergeist? Is Michael Talbot a product of the mushrooms I ate on my tofu at lunch?
Probably the latter.
In Pete's view, it's probably the latter if you wanted an answer to your question. Yes.
I don't want to diverge into psychedelic alchemy too much, but this is a favorite subject of mine, Fred.
Why me?
You've been a tachyon too?
I've been a tachyon.
Yes.
The reason I'm saying that someone I know, you know him, sure, Dr. Ralph Abraham.
Yes.
UCSC, as people may know, he's pretty much of a hotshot in chaos theory. He, quite a while back, before a lot of this stuff came out in popular media showing, visualizing fractal math and so on, you know, he was doing visualization on a computer and making videos of it. He came down to a video studio that brought a tape down that he'd done with some parallel processing and put it on, and I said, Jesus, Ralph, this looks just like DMT. He goes, "Yeah, it is." And it goes back to that experience, you know, on that or ketamine or what, you know, or LSD when I thought I'm a tachyon, I'm a molecule, and so on. And that, however, you know, that fundamental patterning, that chaos patterning, the way it was illustrated was exactly what was being seen. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Me?
You.
I mean, in terms of
DMT, is that the...
No, I mean, in terms of...
Ketamine? Which is it?
Well, either. It's irrelevant. The fact is, when one has a subjective feeling of having become
losing one's ego, becoming something else, getting down on the subatomic level or so on, and, you know, perhaps visualizing patterns. Okay. When I saw that the patterns I was visualizing not only looked trippy and looked psychedelic, but they were, in fact, the real basic patterns of the chaos equations, that pretty much hit a bell, and I'm curious of what, you know, what's happening inside here when that happens.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're all curious about, you know, I'm not sure I can even answer that question. I just make a, sort of a comment on it, I sort of sneak up on just a little bit here. The shamanic reality that I decided to experience for several periods of time, the last one was for about a month in the Peruvian jungle, taught me something, because they allowed me to participate with them as a shaman's apprentice. So shamans deal with the death world a lot. I mean, death is a very, very important part of their world. And I was trying to figure out some of the things that were happening to me, and also some of the things that they told me about, and some of the things I learned from studying with other shamanic types, particularly the Druid teachings of Thomas Maughan, that I spent some time with him when I was in England in 1974. That's when I met Peter. And what I finally figured out is that at the moment of death, consciousness actually goes tachyonic. So this explained a lot of things to me, because first of all, there is this kind of a process in which you get to see your life run by you backwards through time, and I couldn't figure out how this could be going on, and I began to think that there was nothing in relativity theory which forbids an observer from going at any speed. What relativity forbids is a particle having any inertia mass from going at any speed up to the speed of, in excess of the speed of light, or at the speed of light. But an observer can travel at any speed. So I just went through Einstein's relativity transformation equations and figured out what would an observer see. And lo and behold, what comes out is you get a nice journey backwards through time. And you get a chance to see events taking place in a kind of a reverse order. So it could be possible that what we're dealing with in the death realm is a kind of a tachyonic experience, and that may be why you drop the body, because the matter field ain't going to go with you. But
it can't go where you have to go.
Yeah, that's right. It can't go where no one's gone before. You're about to go on your Star Trek adventure, and this is what maybe death is really all about. Anyway, so I welcome you to the death realm. It's fun. It's better than Disneyland.
I don't want to advocate drug use per se, but ketamine, you know, it's a dissociative anesthetic, and it's typically known that people, subjectively at first, have a death experience. And you know, in some past history of mine, when I first did it, I, you know, literally saw myself in a hole in the ground, a stone being put on top. And I knew I was dead, but I felt okay because, like, I was alive. There was so much more. I saw myself being moved under a cart or underground and saw some beings in white and they give me a nod like everything's okay. And voila, I entered into what seemed like, you know, an interconnected, like, tachyon field of just, you know, neural networks and so on. And that seems to be pretty typical for that kind of experience. So it seems like, you know, as in near-death experiences, perhaps under that kind of dissociative anesthesia, one is experiencing that death kind of transformation.
I'd like to say a couple of things. One in response to you, back then, also to Fred. I mean, what you were saying, first of all, about the death experience, I mean, it's interesting. That gives me the image, like at death, you go faster than the speed of light, so you get catapulted back in time. So what's to stop you going all the way back through your own life, back to the beginning of the universe, if it had a beginning?
It happens.
So it's almost as if life takes you up to that point, and that's as far as life has got, then back to the beginning of the universe.
But you can also go forward in time tachyonically too. It works both ways.
I also thought the question you had about infinities and fractals and psychedelics and patterns, it just strikes me that a lot of what happens in those states is experiences of infinity in some way, and what fractals have, those fractal patterns, is they are in a way a pictorial representation of infinities, but in a very finite plane. I think that's why there's a lot of similarities. It's that portrayal of infinity in patterns.
I can say definitely with ketamine, for example, very often ends up in this kind of universal sense of infinity and like being up, you know, in the void is well beyond time and space, and that, you know, that feeling that you're really into something else.
At least fractals have legitimized psychedelic art. I think we should hear from Bob.
Okay, I just want to ask a question here. How many of you who are here... By the way, are we going to have enough bulletins for everybody, Thomas? Are we possibly going to run out? Okay. If you don't get a new sense bulletin or one of its predecessors, BrainMind, and you want to just give us your address and we'll see to it that you get one. I have a question before we go to Robert Anton Wilson. How many of you who are here became interested in these theories about reality because of experiences you had in meditation, dreams, out-of-body, psychedelics, whatever? How many had personal experiences that preceded your curiosity?
The 60s,
right, which is experience. Okay, and how can I put these questions in a safe way?
Don't put it in danger.
Take a chance.
I'm kind of taking the measure of the realities in here. How many of you experience on the basis of maybe several times a year what you would consider to be psychic phenomena? How many of you had experiences that would now be considered that you know now would be considered that kind of thing when you were children? Okay. Thank you. How many saw auras as children? Okay. How many saw what you now think were probably apparitions as children? Okay. How many of you heard voices when you were children? Right, okay. Some people lose it, all right. How many of you have had what you would describe loosely as past life experiences? Uh-huh. Okay, thanks. How many of you wish you did?
I was shown in the plane in a past life.
I have to say, this mention of the business about going backward and forward and so on, Neil Rogan, some of you probably know Neil Rogan. Neil Rogan is writing a book called Amnesia Squared, and we published the first section of it in New Sense in the new issue of it. And it's about there's a planet, another planet in our solar system that we don't know about. And the reason we don't know about it, according to Neil, is it's totally opposite the sun from us. So it's always invisible to us. And that in that planet, it's like everything happens in the opposite direction from us. So people are born old and they get younger. And they have this digital watch that lets them know just how much time they have. So there's very little procrastination on that planet. Stella,
thank
you.
Is it my turn?
Your turn.
Somebody back there said he didn't want to advocate drug use. Why the hell not? It's a funny thing, but almost anybody, no matter how new age they are, still has this tendency. If you go to a doctor, you expect to get a drug. If the doctor doesn't write out a prescription, you feel there's something wrong. If the doctor says, wait 7 days and it'll go away, or drink more water for 7 days and it'll go away, you come out feeling you were cheated and you go to another doctor. Everybody expects drugs are the answer to everything. Everybody in our society advocates drugs except the Christian Scientists. And we're supposed to have a war on drugs. We do not. Everybody is using drugs. Everybody is prescribing drugs. Drugstores are doing a thriving business. We've got a war on some drugs. This is a sugar-addicted, caffeine-addicted, heavily wired, hostile society. I said this morning at my workshop, I said, this is a mildly hostile society. And then I stopped and realized how absurd that was. I was trying to break the news to them gently. But you go anywhere in the world and ask them, what do you think of white European American civilization? And they'll tell you, those motherfuckers are murderers. They come in here and they blow our villages up, they rape our women, they burn down things. We're not a mildly hostile society. We are the most paranoid and murderous society on the planet because of the addiction to sugar and caffeine. And because of our dread of drugs that slow us down, pacify us, and open our minds, like marijuana and other psychic plants. I entered the 60s 1 year early. Village Vanguard, a certain jazz musician who might not appreciate his name being mentioned, was having a joint with some friends when I walked in, and since they knew my face from seeing me in the audience so often, they said, "Want to talk, man?" I said, "Yeah, yeah, I've been waiting and waiting. How do you ask?" And back in 59, it was hard to ask. And so I got my first talk of marijuana in the men's room at the Village Vanguard in 1959. And I haven't had a straight day since then. I have been warped, bent, and twisted out of shape ever since then. 10 years later, in 1969, I happened to be having lunch with Alan Watts, who turned me on to acid. And Alan, I always wondered whether his middle name was Wilson, and I always wondered whether that was a synchronicity or just a coincidence. And I mentioned him, I was writing a novel with a friend, Bob Shea. The novel was called Illuminatus, about the Illuminati. And Alan said, "Oh, that reminds me, the best book I've read all year is called The Eye in the Triangle." And I thought Alan was pretty damn bright, so I rushed out and ordered a copy of The Eye in the Triangle. I had no idea what it was. It turned out to be a biography of Aleister Crowley, who wrote several papers on the psychology of hashish, among other things. He wrote quite a few interesting things. So I got interested in Crowley, 69, 10 years after I first started turning on. By 73, I had gone so crazy, I was so warped and bent and perverted, out of shape and twisted, that I was doing the invocation of the Holy Guardian Angel according to the classic Kabbalistic method of contacting higher intelligence as modified by Crowley, who added the instruction to use wine and strange drugs and a few other tantric gimmicks he had picked up in India about which it is unlawful to speak, as he used to say, which people thought it meant something mystical. It just meant we're living in a savage society where you get your ass thrown in jail for speaking too frankly about certain subjects. And I contacted the Holy Guardian Angel, and to my astonishment, the Holy Guardian Angel was not a creature out of the Bible. The Holy Guardian Angel was an extraterrestrial from the system of the double star Sirius. Then I started rereading Crowley's works, and I found all these coded references to Sirius in there. My God, I've contacted an extraterrestrial. I was high for about a year afterwards. I'm getting all these messages. I'm getting visions of the Holy, visions of past, present, future, alternative realities, all sorts of psychedelic, paranormal, anomalistic experiences, perceptions, forbidden ideas. And then a friend took me to a psychic reader in Houston while I was there. And the psychic reader, as soon as I came in, said, "You're a channeler." And I said, "What?" She said, "You are channeling the spirit of an ancient Chinese philosopher." And she gave me a whole history of this Chinese philosopher I was channeling. And I went home and I thought, is it possible that all the time I thought I was getting messages from an extraterrestrial, I'm actually channeling a Chinese philosopher? What were these ancient Chinese into anyway, besides Taoism? So I got involved in the physics consciousness research group where I met Fred, and another physicist in that group, Saul Paul Sirod, gave me a paper by Evan Harris Walker, another physicist who works in weapons research but writes really fascinating theoretical papers. And Evan Harris Walker took up Bohm's hologramic model of the universe, and the one of the important part of Bohm's theory is the idea of hidden variables, which hidden variables pre-exist space-time, therefore they coexist with all parts of space-time equally. You can't say they're here and not there. Hidden variables are non-local. Everything we knew in physics and science before the non-locality theory appeared in Bohm was always somewhere. It's either here or there. It's either now or then. Non-local things are here and there and now and then, everywhere and every when. And Evan Harris Walker took this non-local model. There are two kinds of, quote, reality. There's local reality, which science has been studying up until Bell's theorem and the whole hologram model. And then there's non-local reality, which is not limited by space and time. And Walker suggested, just as this is true of certain variables in quantum mechanics, it's also true of what we call consciousness. Consciousness is one of these hidden variables. So consciousness is not in my brain, as they've been teaching me all since my college days. My brain is just a local receiver. Consciousness transcends space-time, and every brain is a receiver. Just like, to go back to the metaphor, Johnny Carson is not in the television set. The television set just receives Johnny Carson. And I thought, oh, that's what it is. I've contacted the non-local mind. That's what they call the Buddha mind in the Orient, the Atman. Well, okay, it's not a Chinese philosopher or an extraterrestrial. It's the Atman. I got another psychic reading, and I was told it was a medieval Irish bard. And sure enough, I found all sorts of coincidences, synchronicities, and things in my dream diary going back to my adolescence when I first started recording my dreams, showing I was channeling a medieval Irish bard from around the period of Raftery. And along about then, along came the split brain research, and I developed this model. I finally understood what was going on. What it was is that my left brain, which had hypnotized me up until then, had begun receiving information from the right hemisphere, which is non-local, holistic, it's not linear. And so all it was the left brain getting information from the right brain. So now I could talk about it without sounding like a lunatic. I went around talking about it, lecturing about it, and so on, until the left brain, right brain model broke down entirely, and we started getting all sorts of new ideas in neurology. Along about then, I was looking at a movie called Harvey, which is about a 6 foot tall white rabbit from County Kerry, who can stop time and take you off into parallel universes, just like the parallel universes in quantum theory. And you can find anything you want if you find the right parallel universe. And you can spend hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years over there on alternative realities with Puka. And when you come back, it's the same time you left here, because there's no time over there. It's like light. It has no time. Time is only in our realm. The point of view of the Puka is like the point of view of light. And there's an orderly in the play named Wilson who got my attention because of my interest in synchronicity. I thought, this Wilson is the most interesting character in the play because I was an orderly once in a hospital. And my name was Wilson. And he was the one who was most skeptical about the existence of Harvey. When he found out the technical word for the Harvey species is Puka in Gaelic, he looked it up in a dictionary, and it's the word got into the English language, even though it's Gaelic. And you do find in some dictionaries, and Wilson in the play found the movie. I saw the movie version of the play. He found Puka in the dictionary. The definition was a Celtic elf or vegetation spirit, wise but mischievous. Full of rum pots, cracked pots, and how are you tonight, Mr. Wilson? And Wilson dropped the dictionary, and I sat up, and I thought, now it's talking to me from the television. So I decided that, and like the umpire in Fred's story, it's not a ball or a strike until I call it. The Zen riddle is, who is the master who makes the grass green? Nasruddin went riding through Baghdad one day on his donkey, up and down every street, in and out of every alley as fast as he could go. People said, Nasruddin, what are you looking for? He said, I'm looking for my donkey. It carries us around, and we're looking for it all the time. We are the one who decides. We make the grass green. We decide what's pleasant, what's unpleasant, what's bearable, what's unbearable. When we should commit suicide, how much we can we create all these realities. So when I'm dealing with a certain type of people, I talk about this whole process as transformations going on within my brain as new circuits are opened by various neurological experiments I did based on the use of drugs and traditional Eastern and Western occult ideas adopted for the modern world. When I'm talking to an Irishman, I say, you know, I had a lot of experiences with a puka, and the Irishman, oh yes, we go. And so it depends on who you're talking to, which metaphors you use. The non-local model, which is another word for the holographic model, the non-local model is the best model for talking to people with a scientific background. But I prefer the puka model for talking to ordinary people, because ordinary people can understand a 6-foot tall white rabbit from County Kerry. Besides, they can understand it, but they won't take it literally. The problem with models in physics is that people tend to take them literally. And then what does that do? Then they try to stop the next model when it comes along by saying it contradicts the truth we've discovered. And so they set up a new inquisition.
Right.
The puka, you can't do that with. When I heard an interview on Radio Telefiche Éireann when I was living in Ireland, that's the Irish radio television network, they're interviewing a farmer in Kerry. And he's telling about friends who've had experiences with the puka. And at the end of the interview, the interviewer said, do you believe in the puka yourself? And the Kerry man said, that I do not, and I doubt much that he believes in me either. I wrote a book recently called Quantum Psychology, and what inspired this book was hearing over and over again, every time I talk about quantum paradoxes, which I tend to talk about a lot, people would say, that's true on the quantum level, but in daily life, we're actually still living in a Newtonian universe. So I wrote a whole book to prove that isn't true. The basis of quantum, where quantum theory differs from Newtonian, when you go back to the origins, is that it includes a maybe. This is formulated various ways by various quantum models or flavors of quantum theory, but von Neumann simply said we need a three-valued logic, true, false, and maybe. And you tell that to people, they say, well, okay, maybe you need that in quantum mechanics way down there, but you certainly don't need that in ordinary life. Well, okay, I toss a coin. There's a point when it leaves my hand, there's a point when it's definitely heads or tails. In the meanwhile, where is it? It's in the maybe state. And that's not a quantum event, that's a Newtonian event, but it's got a maybe in it. You're walking down the street, half a block away, you see an old friend. My God, I didn't know Fred was in this town. You get closer and it's not Fred at all. Your perceptions are all in the maybe state, but you jump to conclusions and think you know what you're seeing. A Zen master was asked, what is Zen? And he replied, attention. The monk said, could you explain further? And the Roshi said, attention. The monk said, if I'm not too forward, could I ask for further clarification? The Roshi said, attention. He said, well, okay, but could you give me another clue? The Roshi said, it's very simple. Attention means attention. If you are paying attention, well, no, you figure it out for yourself. I'm not going to explain it.
Marker in the house. You never know, who might have a magic marker. I'm serious. Does anybody have a magic marker? I've been known to carry them in my purse. I don't have any idea. Somebody's looking? Yes.
5, 6, 7. 1 minute to 10.
Alas, pardon?
1 minute to 10.
1 minute to 10. Well, wouldn't it be outrageous if we finished on time? That would be stupid.
And we have only 17 minutes.
How much? 13?
17 minutes to go.
17 minutes. We turn into a pumpkin in 17 minutes. Actually, I think it happened in the workshop today that the videotape ended just exactly as I did. Anyway, I figured this whole there was not a whole lot of structure anyway because we were dealing with a pretty fuzzy reality, but it sure went to hell in a hurry, didn't it? You're going to have to use your imagination, okay? This is something, well, I've got some pens, but it would need to be pretty dark up here. I'll tell you what, we'll use our imagination, it'll work the same way. If anybody who's got a piece of paper, if you want to draw this, you can. It's kind of fun. Okay, I'm going to draw it in the air. How many of you have heard of Arthur Young's book, Reflexive Universe, or his Arc of Evolution? Okay, I'm going to give you, I'm glad there are some people here, so try to put your awareness really out there so everybody can kind of pick it up, make this easy. Arthur Young invented the Bell helicopter. It may look as if I'm not responding to what all these gentlemen said, but you'll see it all kind of gets wrapped up in one neat picture that just has to do with the fact that it's all optional. Arthur Young, actually, he was interested in the creative process. This is the kind of guy he was. He thought, I would like to understand something about this. I think I would make something. And he was, so he was flipping through Leonardo da Vinci, and he saw that Leonardo had dreamed up this flying machine. And he took 10 years, and he built the first commercial helicopter. Wrote a book about it called The Bell Notes. That's very interesting. And at the end of that time, he sold what he had done for what now would seem like a very small amount of money, $1 million or something thereabouts, just because he wanted to spend the rest of his life really pursuing deeper levels of creativity like evolution. And he came up with, ended up, he was fascinated with the idea that throughout human literature from ancient days, there was always this thing about the number seven. And he had also spent quite a bit of time looking into seven in mystical systems, and eventually came up with this model of how light, random light, basically enters into matter, becomes dense, and then reaches back up to matter. And so, if you will, draw a big V-shaped thing like so. Okay. And what you want is you're going to have seven levels with the point at the bottom being number four. So just draw little notches so you can make yourself seven little sections on here.
This will probably work enough to give them a clue. It'll be a help.
Okay. Pretty invisible, probably, but at least you can. Okay. Okay, so at the top you have in Arthur Young's model, you have what random light or disorganized light, let's call it. And then, okay, so it's just light. And then you come to what he calls, then is the level of what he calls the particle. Okay, which he draws with just a few little lines scattered. And then the first thing that has any identity is the atom, which is the next level down. And then at the bottom, which is the turning point, is the molecule. And that's the point at which atoms join together to create something that has the ability to do something, some creative capacity to it. So just as well, you can't see this, I don't draw a molecule very well. Okay, then the next level up is the plant. So the plant is moving back toward light, right? It's reaching toward light, so, you know, imagine some leafy kind of thing reaching towards the light. I forgot to say, this is random light. The particle is what he calls moved by charge. And the atom is the first level of identity or centers. It's something that can hold together. Then you have the molecule, which is combination. Then you have the plant, which he calls, it's like a group of centers, a cluster of centers. Then is animal life, which can move, which is mobile in a way that the plant is not. Okay. And then finally is what he called anthropotheos, which is man into God. And it's represented in his little things with somebody in a kind of lotus position.
The one before
is an animal or creature that there's plant and then there's animal life, but the animal has more freedom. And then by the time you get up to this, you know, highest level of consciousness here, it's light that understands, it's almost like by understanding the principles at this point, it's what he calls freedom by determination. Once you know how things work, there's a lot of freedom. Okay, so I thought this was a very interesting model, and it's. I recommend the book because once you get the picture, he took all sorts of life forms through it, and you can see that it works and it works and it works and at every level. Well, One night at a seminar in Minnesota, the group of presenters were meeting together that night, or basically hanging out at the end of a hard day's work. And we started talking about what is the difference between smart and brilliant, or bright and smart. You know, if you say somebody is brilliant, you don't mean quite the same thing as if you say somebody is smart. And even when we say a person is bright, it doesn't have quite the same feeling about it as smart. Is it right? Okay. So we ended up coming up with what I call the arc of intelligence. It has some nice parallels. You start out at the level of kind of undifferentiated energy, and what it could be, if you picture how a new baby is, when they're catch them unawares, they look kind of like this. So I call this stupid. Stupid.
Yeah.
That's not a judgment. It's like the word stupid after you become kind of a stupor. And when you first arrive, you are in a bit of a stupor. All right. So then the baby starts getting it together a little bit, and then the baby, and on through the early part of its childhood, is what you would call bright. You know how little kids look when they're bright. And then comes this, and this is like moved by charge, right? Like in the other system. I forgot to say the animal uses charge to move. And in Arthur Young's system, it's an interesting kind of like parallels across the two sides, too. So here's bright. Okay. But then, unfortunately, as every parent knows, there is the day when the kid moves from bright to smart. Smart is the most dangerous place on the continuum. That's where you first get your identity, just like where the atom was, or in this case, it's ego. Right? Now, smart people, a lot of times, would like to be brilliant, because they know that some people are brilliant, but they don't quite know how to get there. Sometimes psychosis is a shortcut, but it's like not highly recommended. So I'm about to tell you this deep, important principle that was discovered by a group of people several years ago near Minneapolis. And that is that the turning point is silly. And this actually goes back to an idea. I mean, I had said to somebody a couple years before that the same question about what is the difference between smart and brilliant, and he said brilliant people know how to play. And that's interesting, because if you think of the brilliance of a diamond or a stone, it's as it catches the play of light, what we call a play of light. So basically, you can't, it's like you're too locked in here at smart. It's got to be shaken apart by silly. Now, I will tell you that something dangerous happened to you here tonight, but most of you probably don't care. Which is, you laughed a lot. And when you laughed, you were very vulnerable. And so who knows what crazy ideas were spoken up here today that sneaked in because your body was so busy shaking. So many of you here probably know Jim Fadiman and have heard him speak over the years. I said one time to Jim, he was like Bill Cosby of the movement there for a while. And I said, I don't know, think people realize that, but sometimes you say the most important stuff that's said at a conference. And he said, I know. He said, well, people are laughing. They just don't notice what goes in. Okay, so we know that the brilliant people are the people who know how to play with thoughts and possibilities. Now, if you become aware that that's how it works, you become brilliantly silly, or, as the people I met later improved upon it, silliant. You know, so when you get stuck, you're not getting anywhere, you can say, wait a minute, what is it I'm taking too seriously here? That kind of thing. or let me see what happens if I shuffle this information around. Now, where could you possibly go from there?
Oh, this is kind of interesting because you've got
the bright. It does fit with Arthur Young's model because bright people are moved by charge. It's natural energy going through. And Cilia, you're using the charge to move your morning in control of it.
Okay.
The only place you could go from Cilia is the place that we've all been really secretly longing for. Simple. You know, and a lot of times, and this is really dangerous, a lot of times smart people mistake simple for stupid. Anyway, this is a fun model to play with for whatever it's worth. I'd like to just bring up something that I suspect was of interest to the folks up here and to a lot of you, was this planetary convergence that came up in June. How many were aware of it or paid any particular attention to it when the planets came together? It was June 17th.
The
Jupiter, Mars, and Venus
coming together.
I know it's a long time ago. It was clear back in June, but all right, okay.
Yes.
Well, it was Pete here who first called my attention to it, and he follows those things because he lives out in he has a cottage out in the part of England where you can still see the sky and everything. And so he looks at the stars at night. And he had known since last December that those stars were moving together. And so when he was visiting in L.A. I guess it was when you came in, end of May.
Yeah.
That he said, well, you know, there are people who think that something like this, a similar convergence, was what caused the Star of Bethlehem phenomenon. And then he said, but you better look it up, because I'm really not sure which planets were involved. So I sent somebody off to do some research at Griffith Park Observatory. And it turned out the head of the observatory had written a book called The Christmas Star. And in the decade before Christ was born, it was quite a light show. In the year 7 BC, there were 6 planets that massed. And in the year 4 BC and the year 2 BC, Venus and Jupiter and the star Regulus came together. And in 2 BC, which seems the likeliest candidate, if indeed that was the Star of Bethlehem, it was actually on June 17th, which is interesting. So we got interested in this. What happened
on June the 17th? Uh-huh. On June the 17th, the same day, 2,000 years ago virtually, Jupiter and Venus actually crossed in the sky. They overlapped. For 3 hours, they were coincident. You could only see one planet.
Mm-hmm.
And that was thought to be the Star of Bethlehem.
And historically, some people have thought that that was the likeliest candidate, either one of those two, because Regulus is the brightest star in the sky, and it was the main star in the constellation Leo, which was considered the constellation of the Jews.
And Luther the king.
And Venus was considered the queen and Jupiter the king. It's all very poetic. And, you know, if this is all happening on kind of a mythic level anyway, I figure you might as well look at these things. And a lot of people that I knew have been saying for the last 20 years that in their feeling was that the nature of the second coming was Christ consciousness waking up in lots of people rather than a particular, you know, event, particular coming of a Messiah. And it's just going to trail off, I'm afraid. This story's going to take a little bit longer. Can't wrap it up quite that quick. But anyway, it was an interesting thing. So we just decided, well, let's just imagine that this is the second coming and treat it that way, because it's a good time to decide that. I mean, it seemed to a lot of people like it was probably more useful to try to live a Christ-like life than to call yourself a Christian. And so there was that kind of thing. And it turned out a lot of people got about the same idea. Well, then it also happened that the largest solar flare that had ever been recorded happened, right? Where there's a big black spot on the sun. And some of you may have noticed that. The eclipse happened in there. And then there was a whole dance of the planets, wasn't it? Can you describe some of what went on there over a 3-week period?
Well, there was actually Mercury was there as well, but you couldn't see it because it was quite close to the Sun to begin with. But Mercury was then tracking out back from the Sun towards Venus, Jupiter, and Mars. And Venus passed Mars and Jupiter. Then Mars and Jupiter went off and did the same thing with Mercury a month later and formed the triple conjunction. Then Venus went back towards Mercury. And at exactly the same time,
Saturn was in opposition, which means that if you were looking up at the sky and you could see Venus, Mars, Jupiter, possibly Mercury, and even the Sun just setting, Saturn was like straight through you, right out the other end of the solar system. What is interesting means if you were sitting on Saturn, you'd have seen a quadruple conjunction.